This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
The growth of reform has slightly upended a lot of assumptions and estimates there that the likely election result in 2029 is probably going to be different from 2024 in many seats, but just because reform will be doing a lot better. But I'm sure people will look at the 24 result. Political parties, I'm sure, will also wander around saying things like, vote tactically for us. Expect to hear in the future Labour candidates saying only Labour can stop reform, and Conservative candidates will saying only Conservatives can stop reform in this seat. There will be a lot of that. I've on the whole trust voters to listen to that and work out what they think is probably going on. But you're right, there's a bit of calculation in the voting.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast.
In this week's episode, we'll find out why a developer's refusing to build affordable homes, why our Kent councils are £2.3 billion in debt, and we hear about one family's fight to do the right thing by their son. I'm Simon Findlay, the local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Dan Esson, who reports on borough and district councils.
Hello there.
And Robert Boddy, who covers Medway Council.
Hello.
And our special guest today is Martin Baxter from the polling company Electoral Calculus. First up, Dan, what have you been looking at?
So I've been familiarising myself with a planning application for just over 150 homes in a state on the edge of Bobbing, a village quite close to Sittingbourne.
That doesn't sound terribly unusual. What's different about it this time?
So they want to build it on what's basically just one arable field sandwiched between two roads, which, like I say, isn't particularly remarkable. What is strange, though, is that despite the size of the development, they're proposing no affordable housing whatsoever. Usually any development of more than about 10 homes has to provide a certain percentage of affordable housing, or at least financially contribute to the provision of affordable housing elsewhere. But in this case, they've offered none at all, saying it would compromise their profit margins.
Mm. Is that considered a legitimate reason these days?
It may surprise listeners, but yeah, that is indeed fair enough as far as the law's concerned. The National Planning Policy Framework is built explicitly on the premise that it's the private sector that builds homes, not the state, and therefore that the profitability of housing developments is a relevant consideration. The NPPF says about 15 to 20% profit on gross development value is a sustainable level of profit for developers to aim for, and anything below that is officially financially unviable. So Payne's Development, the firm applying to build this estate on the outside of Bobbing, say that they're already looking at subpar profits on this proposal, and therefore they don't need to provide any affordable homes. That technically might be legitimate, but no doubt when it one day comes before Swaleborough Council's Planning Committee, they won't be very happy about it.
Which I'm sure they won't. Thanks, Dan. Robert, what's been happening in Medway?
This week, I've been concerned with a refused planning application in Hoosent Werburgh. Sonia and Steve Butler got planning permission to build a house back in 2018 on a plot and began working on it. Unfortunately, the family have faced a number of huge setbacks, including a contractor taking £80,000 and then only providing half the materials paid for before declaring bankruptcy and not paying any money back. Then, in 2019, they very tragically lost one of their sons to suicide, which severely affected the physical and mental health of another one of their sons. The Butlers decided to put in an application to extend an existing outbuilding in their back garden to provide a permanent home for their son with assisted living, as he suffers from fibromyalgia and ankylosing spondylitis, which both cause chronic pain and fatigue, as well as severe anxiety-based autism. However, Medway Council's planning officers, and ultimately councillors on the committee, decide the application should be refused, even though they say the designs of the extension are entirely acceptable in every way. The Butlers say this is incredibly unfair and the decision is flawed, and they're supported in this by their ward councillor Michael Pearce and Rochester and Stroud MP Lauren Edwards.
So why was it refused?
The claim by Medway Council's planning officers is the house which the annex is to be secondary to doesn't exist. But if you go to Walters Road, you'll see a giant hole where work is obviously ongoing, and the authority itself has said that work has started. The problem the council has is contractors who built the footings for the new house incorrectly put them 80 centimetres out from where they were supposed to be. This was something the Butlers themselves noticed and reported to the council, asking for guidance. They attempted to get the original plans adapted three times, but all were rejected, and the council says the only way forward is to undo the work and redo it in the right place, which the Butlers have accepted.
So what's been the impact on the family? What's next?
For the Butlers, it's a difficulty they really don't need. Their son is suffering with severe medical conditions and is currently living in with friends. But this is not a long-term solution, and so his parents have had to buy a caravan for him to stay in. Sonia and Steve say they're going to appeal, and Councillor Pearce is confident the decision will be overturned, as the house is clearly being built and the annex can only be secondary to it, contrary to what the officers said. But also he believes the council did not follow its own protocol and didn't consider the Hoosent Werburgh and Chattendean neighbourhood plan, which is a must-do for applications in the plan area. The Butlers say they'll fight tooth and nail for their son and his needs, and are committed to ensuring he has a suitable home in the annex by Christmas.
So Simon, what's been happening down your way?
Well, there was a warning from the leader of the Conservative group at County Hall that the levels of debt being racked up by the 14 councils in Kent could render government reforms of local councils, as he put it, unworkable and unviable in Kent. Between them, these councils owe, wait for it, £2.3 billion, that's with a B, and that amounts to £1,228 per person in Kent. Kent's 14 councils are about to abolish themselves under the new government proposals and will be replaced by four new, much larger unitary authorities. But the KCC Conservative group leader, Councillor Harry Rayner, says that the councils may no longer be able to, says the councils may no longer be there, but the debt stays, and with the real possibility of higher council tax buildings. Councillor Rayner said, "I'm very concerned that with devolution and local government reform, that far too little consideration is being given to the financial implications, and more precisely, the very substantial increase in the cost of council tax."
And have these councils ended up owing so much money?
Well, much of it is historical. Say if a local council wants to build a leisure centre or buy a shopping centre, which many of them do, and it won't have enough money in the pot to do that, it can go to the Treasury-backed Public Works Loan Board for a low-risk, low-interest loan, which minimises the risk to the council. But there are other types of borrowing, such as bank loans and the like. What Councillor Rayner is saying is the fact that when these councils abolish themselves and reorganise it as much larger unitary authorities, there will be more direct debt carried over by the authorities in the east and the north of the county than in the west. Gravesham and Canterbury, for example, have outstanding borrowings totalling, you know, 100 to 200 million pounds each. Ashford has debts of 260 million, but Tunbridge and Morling in Tunbridge Wells, they have none. They have no debts at all. So Councillor Rayner doesn't believe that the local government reforms can work with this level of inequality. Everyone in local government knows this, but the government, the Labour government, which launched the devolution plan last December, has provided little guidance as to how it may be overcome. So watch this space.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
It's a new month, and a new electoral calculus poll brings mixed blessings to most of the parties. And it seems that what is more bad news for Labour is also bad news for Reform, but slightly better news for the Tories, but not much. The Liberal Democrats are holding steady and the Greens will not be grumbling either, but according to new separate analysis, voters are starting to think tactically. And with us today to explain it all is Martin Baxter, who's this podcast's favourite polling pundit. Hello, Martin.
Hi, Simon.
Thanks for coming back on. I think you're the person who's been on this podcast more than anybody.
I'm glad you keep asking me back. It's always a pleasure to be on.
Yeah.
But there's lots to say as well.
There is this time, yeah. Well, I just wanted to recap, actually, on the latest MRP polling that Electoral Calculus put up yesterday. It means that the Labour Party would crash to 153 from its present 412 in Parliament. Reform would climb from 5 to 301, but that's 25 short of a working majority in the Commons. The Tories would drop from 121 to 51, and the Lib Dems might lose one of its 72. Now, that's how it stands as we enter October, but bearing in mind that last month's Electoral Calculus polling had Reform UK with, I think, the 86 majority it was, and now it's 25 short. Now, you reckon that you can see a reason for this?
Yeah, so we actually conducted a major poll with our colleagues at Find Out Now, asking people about their tactical voting, in particular, how they would vote for particular close contests between two parties. A bit like, I don't know, Simon, if you go to the optician and they give you two lenses, A or B, which one do you prefer? We did that with parties. So we gave people choices like, if it's Conservative versus Lib Dem, who would you vote for? If it's Labour versus Reform, are competitive in your seat, who would you vote for? And it was really interesting results. In summary, I mean, your listeners can see all the details on the Electoral Calculus website, but in summary, there's two things going on. First of all, there's partisan voting. The voters on the centre-left will often support other centre-left parties who can win, and similarly for parties on the right. But an extra factor on this is anti-reform tactical voting. So that means people who don't like reform will vote almost for anybody to keep reform out. And we were finding that even one-third of Labour voters would vote Conservative to stop Nigel Farage's candidate from winning in their seat. So not all of them, but similar numbers for Lib Dems and Greens as well. So anti-reform tactical voting does appear to be as pollsters say a thing at the moment. And that obviously hurts Reform, because there's lots of seats where they're doing quite well. But Reform overall are the most popular party in the country on 30%. But it's only 30%. It's not 50%.
Which means 70% are not entirely sold.
That's right. Seven out of 10 voters don't like Reform. And some of those seven don't like Reform quite a lot. And they're prepared to do things that they would normally, you know, shy away from, like a Labour voter voting Labour supporter voting Conservative, but they might do that to keep Reform out. And so that deprives Reform of, in our calculations, a few dozen seats, maybe 60 seats at the moment, and quite a lot of close seats could make all the difference.
Yeah. This wasn't a small sample either. This was, what, 10,000?
We asked over 10,000 people. So, yeah, to get a good view, because there's kind of quite a lot of combinations and things. You've got to speak to enough Conservative supporters, Labour supporters, you know, Green supporters and so on. So we needed a big sample. Mm. So we hope that it's relatively accurate as much as polling can be, and gives people an idea. But it tuned into intuitions that we had. The last election, we saw a lot of anti-Conservative tactical voting. This election or the next election, at the moment, it's anti-Reform plus left-right tactical voting. But equally, it's a lot could change in 3 years. Looking at Kent, one interesting seat is the Weald of Kent, which the Conservatives won in 2024 with Labour in second place and Reform just behind in third place. Now, without tactical voting, we think Reform would win this seat. But with tactical voting, some of the Labour voters, not all, but enough, and some of the Greens and Lib Dems would vote Conservative to keep Reform out. And we think, on our figures, that would be enough for the Conservatives to hold that seat. So that's an example seat where tactical voting could influence the outcome in Kent.
Yeah. It's a very rural seat. There's only two very small towns in the constituency. I think it's Cranbrook and Tenterden. You probably don't know them, but it's incredibly rural, and like most rural parts of Kent and elsewhere in the country, does have its pockets of deprivation. There would be a Labour vote there. But do you think that that's possibly where it's coming from? People think, okay, well, we don't want Reform, we'll vote Tory instead.
That's what our figures show. Mm. About a third of Labour, Lib Dem and Green voters would vote Conservative to keep Reform out.
Mm.
It's not all of them, it's not even half of them, but it is a third. And there are quite a few. At the general election, there were 40% of people voted for centre-left parties.
Mm.
A third of those people is 13% of the total vote. That's certainly enough for the Conservatives to beat Reform.
If you look at Sevenoaks, last time they fought a very localised campaign. Laura Trott, who's a bit of a rising star within the Conservatives, held onto the seat. But the Lib Dems are eyeing that one up. There are two targets, as far as I understand, in Kent. There's the hold of Tunbridge Wells, which probably will happen, but Sevenoaks, they came second there. It's not exactly an Operation Leapfrog target, where they're coming in from third place, but they're actually going to be really throwing some heavy resources into there, I would have thought.
So Sevenoaks is a complicated seat.
It is.
Yes, where our figures suggest it could be a three-way fight between the Liberal Democrats, Conservatives and Reform. Mm. In that case, our relatively sophisticated tactical voting model gives up the fight, actually. It cannot cope with three-way margins,
yeah.
Because
yes.
There's too many possibilities. Anything could happen there. So Sevenoaks will be a difficult seat to predict. But one prediction I'm sure to make is that each of the three leading parties will be urging supporters of one of the other to vote for them as being the only one.
Yeah, they can win, yeah.
Yeah. So that there'll be, expect to see a lot of leaflets in Sevenoaks.
Mm. The sample seems to suggest that Kent's six remaining Tories will go down to two, but that's still double the prediction that there was in September, which were, the Conservatives were going to be reduced to one. Why do you think that this tactical vote sharing is not transferring to the Tories here in Kent, do you think, Martin, or is that impossible to tell?
Well, I'm sure it is making seats, either if they're not swinging to the Conservatives, making them closer. So it will depend, a bit on exactly how many people are voting for which party. If it's moving 60 seats across the country, yeah, you would expect that it might move a couple in Kent, and we might see that as we go, because it's certainly, I don't think Kent is particularly different from the rest of the country in this respect.
Yeah. I mean, given that the Labour vote appears to be collapsing in Kent after having been so strong last time back in July 2024. I mean, could the pressure of time, do you think, just make it worse for reform? Is there too much time to fill between now and 2029?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we need a working crystal ball for that. And just asking, just doing polling doesn't tell us the answer to that.
Mm.
Polling tells us what people think now.
Yeah.
What's going to happen in the next 4 years? A lot can happen. So reform have to keep up their momentum, keep being popular. They've, you know, had a good run since the local elections back in May, but that's, you know, only about 6 months ago. So can Nigel Farage keep it together? Will he fall out with more of his colleagues, or will the show keep rolling on? Will Labour begin, you know, continue to be unpopular, or perhaps Labour will start to deliver on the issues the public care about and will become more popular again?
Mm.
These questions are nobody knows the answers to, but we will all wait and see what happens.
Yeah. Nationally and locally, what do you think the electorate, or at least your very sizable sample, has just sort of appears to have just cottoned on to tactical voting?
I'd say it's the other way around. I think the voters have been thinking about it for a while, and it's the pollsters are waking up and asking the question. So I think we're one of the first pollsters to actually ask tactical voting now. Because normally, we only, as an industry, sort of ask tactical voting in the run-up to the election when people's minds get focused on it. But I think it's unusual at the moment because reform generates strong emotions amongst quite a lot of people, both their supporters and their opponents.
Mm.
And so that's feeding through into people much earlier than usual having a sort of tactical opinion. So I think that's what's different, yeah.
Mm.
So in a normal election cycle, we wouldn't be doing this for another 3.5 years, but we sort of had an intuition that it might be happening, so we decided to ask and see.
It's interesting because the main two recipients of the tactical vote would appear to be Reform and the Lib Dems on the face of it. But what you're saying is that the Tories may be sort of unwitting recipients as well, just because of that anti-reform sentiment, because nobody's going to vote tactically if they support reform. So it would have to be a massive shift away from whichever parties in order, you know, from Labour to the Conservatives to make that make a huge difference.
Well, those people got quite complex and sophisticated views. So Conservatives will vote reform to keep Labour out. Whereas Labour will vote Conservative to keep reform out. Almost everybody will vote Lib Dem to keep, or if they like them better than who they're up against. So there's quite a lot going on. But amongst the left, Labour, Lib Dem and Green will tend to share votes or, you know, vote tactically across those parties. The interesting ones, the refuseniks you hinted at, reform supporters, yes, are less likely to help out Conservatives, say, who are battling the Lib Dems.
Mm-hmm.
Reform voters will tend to stay fixed. They think all the old parties are maybe, you know, tarred with the same brush. Also, we did ask about the new Your Party from Jeremy Corbyn, and their supporters aren't very keen on voting tactically. They're certainly not going to vote Conservative format. They see those two as about the same. So the parties on who are maybe further from the centre of British politics are less keen to vote tactically.
Do people generally know which party to vote for in their constituencies in order to stop reform or another party getting in? Are people that savvy?
Well, I think I always believe people are fairly savvy, but equally some things are tricky to know. That this election or the coming election will be easier than the last one because the boundaries will be the same. If the boundaries change, it makes everything harder. So people can look back to see what the election result was back in 2024, and that will give a clue. But of course, the growth of reform has slightly upended a lot of assumptions and estimates there, that the likely election result in 2029 is probably going to be different from 2024 in many seats, but just because reform will be doing a lot better. But I'm sure people will look at the 24 result. Political parties, I'm sure, will also wander around saying things like, vote tactically for us. Expect to hear in the future Labour candidates saying only Labour can stop reform, and Conservative candidates will saying only Conservatives can stop reform in this seat. There will be a lot of that. I've on the whole trust voters to listen to that and work out what they think is probably going on. But you're right, there's a bit of calculation in the voting in the next time.
The Lib Dems were in pretty good mood down in Bournemouth the other week, feeling very chipper at the parlous state of the Tories and Labour. But they don't really appear to be shifting much in the polls, either, you know, from, you know, undecided or tactical voting. There doesn't seem to be a shift. They seem to be sitting around somewhere around the 70, 72 mark, which is what they've got at the minute. Why do you think that? Have they just not cut through?
It's true they've not generated very many headlines recently, but on the other hand, for one of the established parties, they're doing really well because their vote and their seats are not collapsing. Both Labour and the Conservatives are looking possibly very difficult scenarios with large losses at the next election. Lib Dems, in a way, are sort of quietly getting on with it and look like they are going to survive. They are, you know, a stable centrist party. When other people are moving more away from the centre of British politics, they're staking out the centre ground, and it seems to be working for them. So I'm not writing the Liberal Democrats off at all. They might not create fireworks and shouting matches, but there's a chunk of the British public that quite likes that.
Yeah, okay. I mean, the Lib Dems are about to launch what they've called Operation Leapfrog, where seats where they performed well in third place become targeted for the prevailing winds are there for them. Do you think that's a strategy where you can target a third place? Do you think that can work?
Well, there's a lot of dynamism going. I think it will probably depend seat by seat. The Liberal Democrats have shown over the years they are experts at picking the seats where they can do well, putting resources into those seats and getting results that go against expectations. In some elections, the Liberal Democrat overall national vote share can go down and the number of seats they win goes up. So they're very good at getting, you know, the best bang for each voting buck, as it were.
It does seem that, because I've heard, this could just be rumour and speculation, but that they would be looking to try and sort of get above 100, but really they were looking to get above 120. Now, if the Labour vote collapses in the way that one poll at the weekend suggests that it might, and they'll fall below 100, suddenly they become the opposition to Reform, if Reform forms the government. You know, there is that dynamic going on there. So, as you say, but they would have to target X number of seats, i.e. that hold on to the ones they've got and then go in and very carefully pick off the ones they think they can definitely win. They don't have a national sort of movement or momentum behind them in the same way as they say Reform or any of the established parties have.
So, I mean, obviously in the current political environment, almost anything can happen. But at the moment, we have the Liberal Democrats very stable and around about 70 seats. So they're not going down very much. They're not going up very much. And we still have them in third place in Parliament after Reform and the Labour Party. So the big loser at the moment are the Conservatives. Liberal Democrats we see as stable, but as it approaches the next election, the classic behaviour is always that the Liberal Democrats become more popular in the run-up to an election, partly as people, slightly harsh joke, is remember that they're there and go, oh yes, the Liberal Democrats. So it will depend a bit, but if we see British politics moving away from the centre a bit to Reform, to Jeremy Corbyn, then that might create more space for the Liberal Democrats in the middle. So there's potential there, but at the moment it is potential rather than a likely outcome.
Okay. I mean, it's too early to say whether Labour's conference in Liverpool will have made any difference to the fortunes of the party, but do party conferences tend to give parties a polling boost?
I think there's maybe a little short-term effect. I mean, I can't remember exact numbers on that, but I don't think it moves the dial very much because on the whole, most people are sensible and most people don't watch party conferences in detail. So they might see a little bit of leader's speech on the news. I think people's decisions are more affected by the issues they care about, which are still the economy, immigration and healthcare, rather than following the minutiae of who said what at the party conference.
Martin Baxter, founder and CEO of Electoral Calculus, many thanks for your time today.
Always a pleasure, Simon. Thank you.
The Prime Minister used his party conference speech in Liverpool this week to come out swinging, monstering Nigel Farage and talking about patriotic renewal. Dan, did Sir Keir Starmer do it for you?
Well, it was a good speech for Keir Starmer's standards, but I'm not sure that really speaks to either the quality of the speech or his skills in general. It was decent, it was relatively engaging as far as conference speeches go, but he's really, as we're recording this, the 40th anniversary of Neil Kinnock's very famous Labour conference speech, where he too railed against sort of factional enemies, which I think is a much more impressive affair.
Well, I think he was actually railing against the militant tendency,
Keir Starmer purged their successors from the party several years ago, so it doesn't even have them to shout about.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I thought the speech was fine, basically, but not. I think the glowing write-ups of it are a bit too overexcitable. A lot of the stuff in that is the kind of thing I think anyone paying attention to British politics could have told you many years ago, that working class voters feel the Labour Party patronises them and looks down to them, that people no longer have faith in politicians or politics and that kind of thing. It's like, well, I don't think you, fair play to him for realising it, but I think most people knew this a while ago. And also, I don't think it jars very well with, you know, he says, you know, Britain isn't broken. He's been saying this for a long time. And yet he seems to recognise all of the symptoms of that brokenness in a public which don't trust people like him or politicians, and in an economy which he openly says isn't really working for most people. So I think essentially it was filled with completely anodyne observations backed up by policy proposals which were ultimately amount to more sort of bureaucratic tinkering, and that's what he's good at, and that's what he thinks will fix
it. One of the commentators on the radio this week was saying that effectively he uses this technique where, you know, when he's got the audience applauding, rather than stop and waiting for the applause to subside and then carrying on the speech, what you call surf the applause with even more, and it gives the impression that everyone's in a state of high excitement, but it's actually a very well-worn technique that you wouldn't have had in the time of Kinnock, but Kinnock probably did it at the time, but in very different circumstances.
There's a clip of which is quite famous and often does the rounds around Labour people on social media who need to pull themselves from depression, of Gordon Brown doing something very similar in his first party speech in 2008, defending the record of New Labour, shouting about the winter fuel allowance and reduction in household bills, all that kind of thing. And he employed very much that same technique, and it works very well if you have very few achievements to shout off, but very many people clapping for you.
Plus there was a lot of flag waving. People were saying on the radio also that it's very difficult to clap when you're holding a flag.
They're explicitly ordered to hold flags by him during the speech.
Yeah. Anyway, Rob, people seem to think that was enough to get him off the hook for a little while, but he's got the budget coming up in November and he's got the May elections, so you've always believed that they won't get rid of him, or they don't think that they would be mad to get rid of him. Has your opinion changed anything off the back of that?
I think the narrative, as you say, is definitely that this was the speech that pulled him back from the brink and has really sort of changed the game. The view of Keir Starmer is actually, you know, we've heard for weeks that he's out of control, he doesn't know what he's doing and this sort of thing. Some of the commentary around this speech is kind of the exact opposite. I don't know where, you know, something, the truth probably lies in between those two. I think we've seen a couple of hints of what might be in the budget. The two-child benefit cap has been suggested to be lifted, but that's not entirely confirmed. They're trying to sort of lay the groundwork and make clear that they're going to find the money to fund that and that sort of thing. So I think the headline is that Keir Starmer, oh, everything's great, but a lot of the issues that were there anyway are still there. It's just that people who were egging them up previously are not doing so much anymore. I think he will survive quite a bit longer, and I think it might only be because there's no real suitable successor, particularly since Andy Burnham kind of flamed out, which again could have been entirely a media confection that he was going to challenge anyway. But
I think he was making it pretty plain that he was critical of it. But the problem is he hasn't got a seat.
Exactly.
If he did take a seat from somebody, winning MP, just who's might going to be prepared to stand down early. Mm. There's no guarantee he'll win it anyway. Give up your career and then suddenly you haven't got a seat or a job.
Yeah, and then that opens up a whole new can of worms of, well, who becomes the mayor of Greater Manchester, you know, and he's kind of the figurehead for that. And finding somebody to replace him of the same sort of stature would be incredibly difficult. But in terms of Keir Starmer, I think it was as good a speech as he could hope for. I think he'll be very pleased with the way it's been spoken about.
Yeah.
But you know, as Dan sort of hinted at, most people don't really pay attention to what goes on at the conferences. They just want to know, you know, are my bills going to come down? Is the country going to go in a vaguely correct direction? This might get some of the party members off his back for a couple of weeks at least. But
I mean, the party conference, they're not generally sort of very much interested to other than people who are interested in politics, people who belong to political parties, or people like us who cover politics. Mm. I mean, nobody on the street is talking about the party conferences, you know. Perhaps they might have been talking about reforms one, because it was, you know, it was quite sort of controversial. But there's also the Caerphilly by-election coming up on the 23rd of October, and Plaid Cymru is tipped to take that one. Reform is tipped to come second, and Labour a distant third. Mm. And obviously that's been a Labour stronghold for many, many years. I mean, that will just sort of be the kind of prelude to the November budget, when there may be some good news in it, but the chances are there's going to be an awful lot of bad news as well.
Yeah, I think definitely that's going to be a very challenging, if Labour don't win, and I think it's entirely likely that they probably won't. If Plaid Cymru win that one, the story will be, isn't this dreadful for Labour? If Reform win that one, it will be, look how well Reform is doing and how that's dreadful for Labour. So Labour doesn't come out well from either of those. And I do know that from following former Rochester Institute MP Mark Reckless is big within Reform in Wales. They are really banking on doing well in Wales. They really want to capitalise there. And if they win that seat, they will not be quiet about it.
Well, absolutely right. And I think they're very hopeful about the Senate. Scotland's a different matter altogether because they really will be coming from nowhere. So if any kind of percentage share of the vote, and not necessarily that many seats, or if any seats at all, that will be adjudged a success. Okay, folks, that's your lot this week. Thanks to Dan and Robert for the contributions and to our special guest, as always, Martin Baxter. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage, and you can sign up to our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.